of time. Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst. Khabir Abusada, thank you so much. Professor of Political Science at Al-Azhar University. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batapwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallah. أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون. الكروت ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Turkey's presidential election seems likely to go to a runoff as no candidate has so far succeeded to win a majority vote, an outright victory. Thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are to go on a one-day hunger strike in protest of the regime's repressive policies. And the U.S. Deputy Treasury Secretary warns of a looming recession and the loss of millions of jobs if the country defaults on its debt. Thanks for joining us. The Turkish president's presidential elections is very likely to head to a runoff, as none of the candidates have so far managed the 50% threshold to win outright. After around 98% of the votes counted, the incumbent president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has fallen below 50%. His main rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, is also trailing with 45% of the ballots. Official results will be announced after all ballot boxes are counted. Turks went to the polls on Sunday to elect 600 members of parliament and the next head of state. Some 64 million people were eligible to vote, and a high turnout was reported. Staying with Turkey's presidential election, where the two top contenders are neck and neck as vote counting is still underway, the incumbent Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his opposition challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu have, however, expressed their readiness for a runoff. Addressing his supporters in the capital Ankara, Erdogan said that he has a clear lead over his main rival, but is ready for a second round if required. He also took aim at Kılıçdaroğlu's campaign, saying that they are trying to fool people with wrong figures. Both candidates have claimed to be ahead in the race and contested the early lead of the vote count. Meanwhile, Kılıçdaroğlu, speaking alongside leaders of the other parties in his alliance, said that he would win the potential runoff. He also took a jab at Erdogan, saying that he could not achieve the results that he wanted in Sunday's vote.
Turkish citizens have cast their votes to choose a president and parliament members. Polling stations opened at 8 a.m. and closed at 5 p.m., with unprecedented participation, especially from the young generation. According to the Supreme Election Board, 4.9 million are first voters in this election.
I voted for Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, of course, because I am a young person who wants to live in a democratic country. Now our country is not democratic. And because I want to change, I want to reshape my future with Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, of course, because we believe in him, because we saw current president for like almost 20 years.
Some said they voted to change the country, while some others said they voted to revive the legacy of the founder of Turkey.
Ben Cumhuriyet Halk Partisi'yim.
I will vote for CHP, the party that was created by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Atatürk said, I left you two legacy. The first is the Turkish Republic and the second is the Republican's People Party.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan cast his vote in Istanbul. He said he is happy the election is going smoothly without any incinerators, especially in areas affected by the earthquake. Many believe Erdogan's presidency should not end, arguing Turkey in his era became a developed and modern country.
Cumhurbaşkanı Erdoğan'a vereceğim.
I will give my vote to President Recep Tayyip Erdoğan and AKP. The most important reason is that in the past 21 years, he made Turkey one of the best countries in the world. He built roads, hospitals, manufactured our own defense system. This is the first government to work on manufacturing its own drones. What else do we want?
Many believe today's election will determine the future of Turkey's ruling system, especially with opposition candidate promising to bring back the country's parliamentary system if he became the president. Turkish people have cast their votes. While some here want everything to stay the way it is, others believe it is time to change, and the future of Turkey will be determined once election officials count the votes. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are to go on a one-day hunger strike on Monday in protest at the regime's repressive policies. The Palestinian inmates also demand the release of their fellow inmate, Walid Daqqa, who has been behind bars for 37 years. The movement, which represents Palestinian prisoners, has called on all free people of the world to pressure Israel to release Daqqa, saying that he is facing an imminent risk of death. Daqqa is a Palestinian writer and activist who was imprisoned in 1986. The one-day strike will also call for an end to solitary confinement of Palestinian prisoners by the Israeli regime. The strike is part of an ongoing action that demands prisoners' rights, including an end to the so-called administrative detention. That is a policy which the regime has been pursuing to hold Palestinians without charge or trial for an indefinite period. In Egypt, a brokered ceasefire between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel has largely held. Palestinians say they will respect the truce as long as Israel does not breach it. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Amid contradictory reports on the contents of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad in the besieged Gaza Strip and Israel, Palestinian experts say that the Israeli regime is to abide by the agreement, at least for the time being, but they add that it's unclear how long the latest ceasefire will hold before the regime breaches it. Israel's seriousness will be determined to some extent by the length of the period of calm, they say.
Whether the Israelis are going to commit to this ceasefire, as we know that this is not the first time we have truce or ceasefire. It happened hundreds of times before, and all the time it was Israel who broke this kind of agreement, not just because the Palestinians do anything, but because the Israeli themselves and in this kind of regime, the colonial racist regime, it's used to that.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during a cabinet meeting on Sunday, told his ministers that the Israeli military took out the entire leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and by doing so fulfilled the goals of the so-called Shield and Arrow operation in perfect form. He also claimed that Tel Aviv had changed the equation and thwarted the entire top of the jihad movement. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has demanded that targeted killing be carried out against Palestinian resistance leaders in the West Bank as well. He added that the last operation was good and important, but it must be continued.
The most important thing is that the Israeli regime failed to achieve any political goal, failed in restoring deterrence, failed in oppressing the resistance or creating a fraction between the Palestinians themselves or between different factions. Netanyahu has maybe temporarily succeeded in regaining his popularity. However, he will face his problems within days. This round is failure to Israel.
Analysts, meanwhile, say one of the reasons Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire is Thursday's controversial flag march that is held every year by the Israelis to mark the occupation of East al-Quds in 1967 Six-Day War. This annual event has prompted fightings in past years as the Israeli regime insisted not to reroute the flag march away from the Muslim quarter of al-Quds. Palestinians wonder whether the Israeli policies and killings in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds would affect in a way or another the inevitability of the ceasefire, mainly after Ben-Gvir's call to assassinate resistance leaders in the West Bank. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Yemenis have taken to the streets across the country to mark the 7th anniversary of the creation of the Israeli regime, known as the Day of Nakba, or Catastrophe. Rallies were held in the capital Sana'a, as well as other major cities, like Sada and Al-Hudaydah, to express solidarity with Palestinians. The demonstrators condemned the expulsion of Palestinians from their homes and ethnic cleansing by the Israeli regime. They called on the international community to take action to stop Israeli aggression and expansionist policies. Nakba Day was also marked with similar rallies elsewhere across the world. Rallies were held in many cities across the world, including Vienna, Rotterdam, Paris, Berlin, and Toronto. The demonstrators also slammed the failure of the international community to take action against Israeli atrocities. In London, protesters chanted slogans denouncing the UK's role in the creation of the Israeli regime. Nakba Day marks the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Zionists who had moved to Palestine from various countries drove over 750,000 Palestinians into exile and wiped off more than 500 towns and villages off the map.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
It's today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora, the Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession, and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza. Once again, suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out.
Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanctions on Israel. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanctions on Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long. And we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
From the disgrace of the Nakba to today's resistance, the 75th anniversary of the occupation of Palestine is a time to reflect on the long way the oppressed nation of Palestine has come in its struggle for freedom, while shedding light on the numerous instances of human rights violations committed by Israel in the Palestinian territories.
There are over 1,000 Palestinians currently jailed in administrative detention with no charge or no trial under a Zionist regime that can indefinitely extend their detention, leaving them jailed with no charge or no trial for years on end.
The issue of Palestine is the most important issue in the Muslim world, and Nakba is an occasion for all of us to condemn the atrocities against Palestinians. Resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine.
The Nakba has greatly influenced Palestinian culture, and now a new generation of Palestinians is ready to make the ultimate sacrifice in the fight for freedom.
Resistance has paid off. After years of resistance, now we have reached a point where there is no talk about the Greater Israel Project. That image of an invincible army has been shattered.
It's true that the Israeli regime has tried to create the impression that it's strong. We all know that they have the support of world powers. But today, the regime is facing lots of domestic problems. That's mainly the reason for the escalation of raids and attacks in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. It's a way to deviate attention from its internal issues. But the international community is now more aware than before.
Today, the word Nakba and what it stands for is known to all who are preoccupied by the Palestinian cause.
This year on May 15th, the United Nations will be holding a high-level special meeting to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba. This is the first time that the international body is marking the date, recognizing the historic injustice suffered by the Palestinian people. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
France says it will send dozens of armored vehicles and light tanks to Ukraine in the coming weeks to help the country in its war with Russia. That was announced in a joint statement after the French President Emmanuel Macron held talks with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, in Paris. France also indicated that it was concentrating its efforts on supporting Kiev's air defense capabilities against Russian strikes. Zelensky's visit to Paris was part of his weekend tour of several key European allies to drum up military and financial support ahead of an expected counteroffensive against Russian forces. The U.S. and its Western allies have already supplied billions of dollars worth of military aid to Kiev. Russia has time and again warned that Western military aid to Ukraine will only complicate the situation. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has once again warned of catastrophic consequences for the nation's economy if the country defaults on its debt payments. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has forecast that the country could default on its debts by June 15 if lawmakers fail to agree to raise current limits on government spending. For weeks, U.S. policymakers, bankers, and the White House have warned that the U.S. is on the brink of a default, which could plunge the country into a recession and see millions of jobs lost. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The U.S. national debt currently stands at around $31.5 trillion. Default would also trigger a global economic downturn. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness ever since. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me.
We have arrived. From this point onwards to the Ayub Cave, no car can pass through, so you have to continue on foot. Have a good trip.
Thank you. Driver said, we are now at a point where no vehicle can go up the mountain. Then it needs the patience of Job to climb the mountain. Hiking for about an hour. Ooh. Spring is the appropriate time for mountain climbing in Kerman province. By the way, I'm going to climb this mountain in order to see a cave which has the biggest entrance in Iran and the West Asia region. Yes, I'm departing to reach the Ayub Cave. Ayub Cave is located 16 kilometers southwest of the city of Dehaj in Shahr Babak of Kerman province. Ayub Cave has taken shape in a mountain with the same name. This mountain is as high as 3,400 meters. Ayub Cave is in a volcanic mountain with igneous rocks. There is a water spring inside the cave that now flows outside through the piping system. The opening of the cave in the mountain is 80 meters and its height is 60 meters. Amongst all the caves known in Iran, Ayub Cave has both the biggest opening and the tallest ceiling. This cave is listed as a National Heritage of Iran.
it. It needs the job's patience to go up the mountain. And of course, it needs mountain climbing skills. I have heard that this cave used to be residential during the Parthian Empire. So the people of that era had to be very skilled mountain climbers. So I should say fewer words in order to save my energy. And here's the cave's opening. You know what? This place is called the history's Big Yawn. Yes, yawn. Oh. The cave's opening is so big that it seems the mountain has opened its mouth and is yawning. Look at there, the eastern part. There is a narrow stream of water which is flowing from the ceiling, pouring into a pool at the cave's foot. I have to taste some. Oh, it's cold. As if it had been in refrigerator. Fantastic. And look at there. It's a small mortar-shaped basin, which is called the Basin of Desires. According to local belief, if someone throws a stone into the basin and it falls into the hole, his wish will be manifested. Interesting myths. Let me go further ahead. Central court of the cave. I would like to take a rest here. This cave has different parts which have taken their names and definitions by local people. It's a magnificent cave. If you're interested in climbing, hiking, and caves, take a trip to Ayub Cave. Sure you like it.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. May the 15th is the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, the date when Palestinians commemorate their dispossession at the hands of criminal Zionist gangs. The Nakba's legacy is, of course, one of great suffering, but it also sparked a jihad against Israel, which is ongoing until this day. And that's the topic of today's show, the Islamic concept of jihad, or struggle in the way of Allah, with particular reference to the noble Palestinian cause.
In the English language world, the term jihad has routinely been described as an Arabic word for holy war, compared to violent Christian religious campaigns such as the Crusades, which saw medieval armies fight for control of the holy sites in modern-day Palestine. If asked, some may also associate the term with Takfiri extremist groups like ISIL. As usual, the mainstream Western understanding of the Islamic term is drenched in misunderstanding and falsehood. In Arabic, the word literally translates to striving or struggle and is used as a term to describe a struggle for the sake of Allah for a praiseworthy aim. Jihad can be distinguished between a lesser jihad and a greater jihad. The greater jihad, and therefore the more important one, is called jihad against self. That is a struggle to subdue one's own ego against evil inclinations and tendencies. It's a spiritual striving to attain nearness to Allah and is a lifelong effort incumbent on every Muslim. The lesser jihad is fighting in self-defense of the community against an enemy that has initiated an attack. It's also an effort to confront an enemy who unlawfully evicts one from one's home and encroaches on the freedom of Allah's worship. Jihad is not intended to shed blood, encourage disloyalty towards established governments, or disrupt peace in any manner. It's about self-defense. A famous hadith recording the words of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, sums this very well.
You have come from the lesser jihad to the greater jihad, the striving of a servant of Allah against his own desires. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
The term is widely used by Muslims that efforts have been made to combat the negative stereotypes surrounding it. A hard thing to do amid continued Western aggression against the Muslim world and relentless anti-Muslim propaganda in mainstream media.
Well, joining us today to talk about jihad and Palestine, we have two esteemed guests. In the studio, we have Robert Inlakesh, who is a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and a political analyst specializing in the Middle East. He has visited and reported from Palestine on several occasions and lived there for over 6 months. And joining us also on Skype, Sharifa Energy is a poet, writer, author, activist, and educator. She campaigns heavily on behalf of all oppressed groups, especially the Palestinians. Salaamu Alaikum. Welcome to the pair of you. In Lakesh, I'm going to come straight to you first of all. Welcome to the studio. I just want to ask you about the concept of Palestine and jihad. In this term, what does jihad mean to you?
Well, jihad can mean a number of things. For instance, for the Palestinian people on the ground, it can be a number of levels of struggle, one component of which is evidently the armed struggle. This is something that the Palestinian people have the right to. They are under attack. Their land has been usurped and is continuing to be usurped by the Zionist entity. And so the Palestinian people have that right, even under the Fourth Geneva Convention. So when we're talking about the right to jihad, this is one of those rights and one of those means of struggle inside of occupied Palestine. But there are also things like protests and social work and a number of different ways in order to struggle against the oppressor. And in the case of people outside of Palestine, whether they be Palestinians in the diaspora or it just be people who are Muslims or those who care about justice, they can commit themselves to another form of jihad. Over here, it could be in the form of boycotts. It could be in the form of advocacy for the Palestinian people. So jihad in of itself can take a number of forms, and one of which inside of Palestine, a core component, is the armed struggle. And that's something, of course, which has been, through a lot of Western propaganda, made out to be somewhat of what the concept of holy war against Jews or Christians or whatever. But really what this is inside of Palestine is a battle from the Palestinian people to defend their homes and to liberate their homeland, which is actually a right in the occupied territories under international law, which they are able to commit themselves to.
You make some really valid points there, Robert. And I want to bring in Sharifa on this now. Sharifa, just tell me about the activism that you've been doing for Palestine. Do you consider it to be a form of jihad as well?
I don't usually use that term, to be honest. But for me, of course, this thing, state violence, whether even in this country, with the police disproportionately killing people, like black people, I feel like, you know, there's always going to be an uprising or resistance from communities that are heavily impacted by state violence, whether it's, for example, the Israeli occupation or indigenous communities from like Canada to Australia, you know, to North America. There's always been people rising up to challenge their oppressor. And of course, I understand in the terminology that is used in this context that you're suggesting. Yeah.
Now, Robert, Sharifa mentioned there that she doesn't normally use the term jihad when describing activism in support of Palestine that she engages in. And I think that there are many other people, Muslims included as well, that live in the West that would agree with that. They don't use the term very much. One of the reasons, quite possibly, would be because it's associated with things like extremism and terrorism, that type of thing. Unfortunately, that is the truth. It's become a kind of dirty word in the West, unfortunately. But it shouldn't be, should it?
No, I think it has been. And for instance, for myself, I don't use that term regularly because you have to understand your audience and who you're talking to. If you're talking to a Western audience who isn't familiar with the terminology, then they're going to interpret that as you being a fundamentalist takfiri who wants to commit a side bombing. So they don't understand that if I use the term jihad to me as a Muslim, this means that I am struggling against oppression and that I am standing up for an oppressed community in work that I may do or that activists may do. So for us as Muslims, this is what this term means. But the meaning of the word has been robbed of us by Western media and its and the Western governments, their so-called war on terror, which was a war of terror against the Muslim peoples. And so, yes, it's become a dirty word. It's become associated with holy war and religious fundamentalism. And so, unfortunately, to use this terminology now for certain audiences is not going to get the reaction which we would hope, which, for instance, in advocacy work for talking about the Palestinian people, we want to try and help people understand what is happening there. And so, unfortunately, that term has been robbed from us.
That is very true. Now, Sharifa, let me ask you, because you've been to Palestine, you've seen what it's like there, and you've seen basically the Palestinian jihad, the fact that they're resisting an ongoing colonialist occupation. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that experience. What did you see?
For example, in Jenin refugee camp, which is also similar in Nablus and places, you've got Palestinians who are involved in armed resistance, you know, places where they've ensured that there's no checkpoints and ongoing from the Second Intifada. Like, even in Jenin, like, there was a lot of settlements that were there on the outskirts. They were removed during the Second Intifada. So even then, it's scary because at night people are sleeping. You'll just know that the army, the Jaish, they've come into the camp and people do resist, you know. There's innocent children that are killed, mothers. It's everyday people, so I don't really feel like you can separate the two, this idea of combatants and non-combatants, who's the innocent party. People have grown up around so much destruction, so much grief, so much, like, PTSD that's just ongoing. I feel, the same way, you know, you could go to places like Bolivia and other countries as well. You see the same thing from people that are not Muslim. People are resisting as indigenous communities, and that is what it's going to be. Of course, in places like Jenin, you're going to have a large Muslim majority. You know, you've still got churches and stuff in Jenin. There's Christians. But at the same time, of course, people are going to identify with it in a certain way.
I'm gonna come back to Rob on this, because one thing I want to make absolutely clear is that obviously when it comes to Palestine, it's very easy to focus on resistance, the fighting, the killings, and the resistance against the colonialism, like the physical resistance to colonialism. But let's remember that jihad is also about, say, for example, just staying in the occupied territory, because there are offers being made for Palestinians to sell their businesses, sell their homes, and to just go away. That's, I think, a major strategy of the Israeli regime. Just pay them to go away and take over slowly. However, the fact that they decide to stay, I think, is a type of jihad, because, again, they're still putting up with the struggle, but in order for the ultimate goal. Would you agree, Robert?
Yes, absolutely. It is a form of jihad for them to stay there, because especially if you're in places like the Jenin refugee camp right now, or in the old city of Nablus, you are going to struggle enormously. If you're in Area C of the West Bank, the chances are your house is going to be demolished, your entire village is going to be demolished. So for people there inside of the West Bank, for instance, in East Jerusalem as well, and even in the Gaza Strip, they're living through hellish conditions. In Gaza, we're looking at a population of 2.2 million people, 70%+ of which are refugees, and they're living in a space which, as of 2020, has been declared by the United Nations as unlivable. They don't have a clean drinking water supply. So this, for them to just remain there in of itself, is a form of jihad and a form of struggle against the Zionist entity. And of course, you know, the armed struggle is what often gets a lot of attention, because they want to paint this as terrorism. But if we look at it in other contexts as well, all people who are suffering under settler colonial occupation have struggled and used armed struggle. There is nowhere you can find on earth where people have not used armed struggle against colonizers and against settlers, settler projects. There is no example. So in all of these examples, sure, people remaining there and using the armed struggle and all sorts of popular struggle is a form of jihad.
Well, self-defense, I think, is something condoned even in international law. Everyone has a right to defend themselves when attacked. Those are some very valid points, Robert. Now, earlier this week, we spoke to Palestinian journalist based in Gaza, Wafa al-Udaini. As a Muslim living under constant threat of war between Palestinian resistance and the Israeli regime, she explained how important the concept of jihad is amid the ongoing occupation of her people's land.
First of all, thanks for having me. Actually, you know, jihad means resisting the occupation, resisting the oppression, resisting the brutality of the occupiers. Actually, you know, as Palestinians, we're daily subject to Israeli occupation, subjugation, and atrocity. So this means that as the landowners, we have to defend ourselves. We have to confront the occupiers who came from outside Palestine, from different European countries, who came as militias in 1948, and then they kicked the Palestinians, who are the landowners, out of their homes, and then they took their homes. So it is really, you know, it is a must for every Palestinian here in occupied Palestine to resist this occupation by all means, not only armed resistance, whether popular or civil resistance and all kind of resistance, you know, because it is really very legal to confront and to stop this occupation, who their mission only to wipe us out of our land, to wipe us out as Palestinians out of the map, you know. So it is really, we consider Jihad, who, you know, we know that they have like a misconception of Jihad, and especially in the West. But indeed, as Palestinians, it is, you know, we can say it is equal to the word resistance here, as they understand it, you know. So as Palestinians, we do believe in Jihad as a kind of confronting any occupiers to our land.
At the beginning of May, pro-Palestinian activists in the English city of Leicester embarked on their own form of jihad by besieging an Israeli arms factory. Elbit Systems supplies drones to the Israeli military as well as weaponry to the British armed forces. Protesters have vowed to shut it down.
Essentially, I believe it's a moral, social, religious responsibility for every single human being of conscience to stand with the oppressed wherever they are, particularly for us as British citizens. Inherently, the Zionist regime could not exist without imperialist support. That's the only reason that it exists, actually. And as British citizens, we have an extra added layer of responsibility, because ultimately it was Britain that handed over Palestine like it was a piece of bread to the UN. It was a Balfour Declaration in 1917 that promised the Jews the inherent right to Palestine as though it was theirs to give. So ultimately, it's in the meeting point between the imperialists and the Zionists that the Zionist project was able to actualize. It was due to the imperialists. Without imperialist support, I must stress this, Zionist entity is unable. Today we're outside of Elbit Systems. Okay, this is very important. This activism has worked. Already, the protesters have managed to shut down the factory in Oldham. They've managed to shut down the headquarters in London. They've managed to basically cancel a £300 million contract with the Ministry of Defence. Because of these protests, ultimately, Elbit doesn't want to go to court because Elbit knows that it will be implicated in court, essentially. They don't want to reveal some of the secret activities that they have conducted, which, by the way, the Ministry of Defence knows about, the state knows about. It was the state that created the Zionist entity. And they will cover and they will stick up for their interests.
Well, there you have it. So an important battle taking place against Elbit Systems, a UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer. Sharifa, let me bring you back in on this, because obviously you've been involved in the protest action there. Just tell me, why is it so important to keep this struggle against Elbit Systems going?
I think in general, it's just to ensure people don't forget that it exists over there, but at the same time to let Elbit know that communities, and not just Muslim communities, majority of the people that are doing actions against these factories are not even Muslim. And I think it's really important for people, for them to know that, you know, the same way when it came to people in South Africa stopping the boats during South African apartheid, and other ways that there is going to be like people that are going to make noise at key places that supply weapons and arm people that are occupying communities.
Robert, one thing that I find very interesting about this concept of jihad is it's linked to, by Western media outlets, it's linked to terror groups like Daesh, for example. But the Muslims who fought against Daesh and were responsible for defeating Daesh and other terrorist groups that have been prominent in the region for quite some time now, they were fighting a jihad against Daesh. We saw Iraqis, they declared fatwa against fighting Daesh and defeating them. So this was a Muslim religious jihad against Daesh, which won out. It wasn't American bombing campaigns which killed some civilians and some Tukfiris, who knows, that won out the day. It was a Islamic World jihad against Daesh, which ultimately defeated them, if you agree. So again, it seems a real shame that jihad is associated with terrorism.
Yes, in fact, as well, when you look at these Takfiri groups, Al-Qaeda and Daesh, they are, in of themselves, they have killed majority Muslims. These are the populations which they targeted, Muslim populations in Muslim countries. And most of the time, Western weapons and Western funding as well. This is another thing. And so when we're looking at these organizations, even Daesh and Al-Qaeda and these sorts of Takfiri organizations in the Gaza Strip have attacked Palestinians there. They've attacked Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And so there's often this conflation between those sort of groups and then groups which are fighting for national liberation, which are completely separate. Hamas has nothing to do with Daesh, and it's not even comparable. Same with other groups like Hezbollah. They were created to liberate their own territory. So for them, again, they fight their own form of jihad in their contexts. So talking about the word jihad, it's been robbed of all of its value, if you're going to use this word in a context, in the Western context.
Now, we've established that. I think you and I have both come to an agreement that the term has become a dirty word. Unfortunately, in the Western world, it has been robbed of its real meaning. But what I want to ask you is, who do you think is responsible for that more so? Because obviously there's the Western world. They do what the Western world does. Western propaganda has been targeting Muslims indiscriminately for a very long time, trying to spin words like Islamist, jihadists, to give them negative connotations. That's normal. But what I wonder is, perhaps Muslims living in the West haven't done enough to safeguard and defend these concepts and hit back, say, no, jihad doesn't mean terrorism. It doesn't mean holy war. Actually, it's a positive word about which Muslims do all the time. They are trying to benefit and improve themselves, seek closeness to Allah, seek closeness to Islam. You know, jihad and all this stuff, like jihadists, Islamists, they're meaningless words which are far from the actual reality on the ground. So do you think that perhaps Muslims are partly to blame for this?
Well, I think the definitions are not known. What is an Islamist? I mean, this is a very broad term. It can mean a good thing. I could be described as an Islamist. So it's and many people can. So when we're talking about the terminology, I think now, at this current time, Muslims can speak up more and be heard when they're talking about these issues. And I think there is a reluctance from some Muslims to talk about these this terminology and these terms and blame them because they're still afraid. But if we're talking back in 2003, when the United States and this country are invading Iraq, there was no space for this sort of dialogue in the Muslim community. There was a concerted campaign which was specifically designed to demonize the Muslim world and to justify killing Muslims and persecuting Muslims. That's what they did. They killed millions of Muslims in the Middle East. And this campaign that they designed was multifaceted. So part of it was a media campaign. Part of it was owning the terms. Part of it was cracking down on Muslim organizations like the Holy Land Foundation, which did nothing wrong, by the way, inside of the United States, and unjustly going after people who were doing charitable work. So back then, I don't believe Muslims could have done a great deal to change the popular perception, because we're mentioned as Muslims on the news on a daily basis. But who can tell us the five pillars of Islam? Who can tell you the difference between Sunni and Shia? Nobody knows this. Most people think that Iranians, Afghans, and Arabs are the same people. So there is a lack of understanding. And now we have a space, I think, in this day and age, right now, to speak up more on this. But in the past, I think it was very difficult.
Absolutely. Now, Sharifa, let me bring you back in once again. We haven't got long left of the show, so I'll give you a chance to educate our audience about the type of action, which I think has become a lot more popular, particularly among Muslims, but also non-Muslims as well, which is direct action. Another example would be, I guess, the BDS campaign as well, which has become very popular, I think, and has achieved some major gains. Could you just explain, do you think that this is the future of activism in support of Palestine, this direct action route?
I think it is effective. Like, there's people that stand up against the Barclays Bank and, you know, highlight their crimes and their support for the Israeli occupation. So I think, you know, people taking a more drastic or, like, in ways that are, like, quite capturing in it from the media as well, for people to actually observe. Like, you know, it's until Pal Action actually brought it to our local community in 2021, where six people were on the roof of a factory outskirts of Leicester. No one knew about this.
Absolutely. And Rob, we literally just have a few moments left of the show. So just very quickly summarise, jihad, of course, is a religious obligation for Muslims. So again, I think in support of Palestine, we're obliged to show more support.
Yes, absolutely. And if you're outside of Palestine, obviously the armed struggle is not an option for you to participate in, and it is illegal in these countries. And of course, Israel is not there. So in this context, it makes no sense. I think things like, for instance, not buying Israeli dates. If you're a Muslim and you have a business over here, why are you selling Israeli dates? I saw this during Ramadan myself, that Muslim businesses were selling Israeli dates. This is something that Muslims over here should do, is boycott action, or just raising awareness if you don't have the ability to do anything else to talk about these issues and to engage with your community on these issues. I think it's very important. And over here, this is perhaps one of the strongest forms of jihad.
Absolutely. Well, thank you to both my guests. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you in the studio, Robert, and to Sharipa. Thank you for joining us online as well. But that's all the time we have for this edition of Eye on Islam. Thank you at home for watching as well. But join us again next week as we will be back for another edition of the show. Assalamu alaikum for now.
In the limelight.
At least 34 Palestinians, including six children, have been killed in the recent Israeli regime bombing campaign. This is while Biden administration quietly backs the Zionist regime's deadly assaults on Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites